It is a distinct pleasure to introduce our baccalaureate speaker, the Reverend Ethan Magnus of Grace Anglican Church. This evening, as we gather in worship and gratitude and sending, we're grateful for his ministry among us and for the word that he will bring. In 2006, Reverend Magnus planted Grace Anglican Church, and under his faithful leadership, the parish has flourished. Today, Grace Anglican is one of the largest parishes in the Anglican Diocese of Pittsburgh and one of the most vibrant congregations in Grove City. He is a man of learning with degrees from Eastern University and Trinity Anglican Seminary. He's also a wise teacher, a gifted preacher, and a faithful shepherd to many in our community, including to many in the class of 2026. I am deeply grateful for the ways his ministry has strengthened our campus and blessed our community, touching the lives of many of our faculty and staff and students. In addition to Grace Anglican, Reverend Magnus helped plant Redeemer Anglican Church in Franklin, and he is currently writing a book on the gospel theology of church planting. Ethan is married to his wife, Monique, and together they are raising three daughters, Cora, Ella, and Avelina. The entire Magnus family, they are a much loved and faithful presence in our community. Please join me in giving a warm Grove City welcome to the rector of Grace Anglican Church and Grove City College's 2026 baccalaureate speaker, the Reverend Ethan Magnus.
There's so many people I love here tonight. I know so many of the faces in the room, and it's a privilege to speak to you. And so a hearty thank you to the staff and faculty and students and so many families that have gathered here tonight. So, weakness, fragility, vulnerability, inability, powerlessness, feeling rather unvitalized. These seem like misfit themes given the festive occasion of baccalaureate and graduation, because today, and especially tomorrow, we do celebrate strength. And we do that rightly, because you've grown, you've changed. I know some of your stories, and I know some of the obstacles that this class has overcome. You've been honed, you've learned, you're more prepared now for life after Grove City College, and because of all of the beauty that you've experienced and the truths that you've learned, you have been shaped by the Lord, and so many feel strong today, which is wonderful. And yet, not everybody feels that way. I mean, not everybody feels strong, even on a happy occasion, because perhaps you've developed here a unique and special circle of friends that have impacted you in ways that have changed and pivoted your life forever, and now you won't see those same friends with frequency. Or maybe you've been mentored by a beloved professor who has cultivated your nature in wonderful ways, and you won't have the same access to them. Or maybe you're already securing a new job and you're not sure what you're getting yourself into. Or maybe you're in a romantic relationship and yet you're graduating and so you're not sure what the future will hold. And those things can make us feel weak. Well, I have a simple goal tonight that is, regardless of how you feel on this occasion, I'd like to offer you a word that you can carry with you for days that lose their sunlight, for the times when the clouds roll in, for weeks or months in which you're feeling depleted, when you're feeling weak. Well, in Paul's second letter to the church in Corinth, he writes with unusual vulnerability and frailty. And I want to speak about three themes from this brief passage this evening. I want to speak about conceit, weakness, and true strength. Conceit, weakness, and true strength. So, conceit. Paul begins in verse 7 this way. So to keep me from being conceited because of the surpassing greatness of the revelations, a thorn was given me in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to harass me, to keep me from being conceited. You know, Corinth was a place that was, at least at that time, infected with a culture of conceit. And it was a particular kind of conceit within the Christian community. It was a religious conceit. Perhaps the most pernicious of all, hiding under the garb of Christian belief. Religious conceit infected the congregations in terms of their own obsession with supernaturalist spiritual gifts. Some had them, evidently, and some didn't. And that created kind of a two-caste system. Conceit manifested itself in terms of super apostles, so-called, that infected the congregations, trying to dispel any bond with St. Paul, trying to show their own superiority over Jesus' own apostles. It even manifested itself in dinner, where you had some people in church gobbling up the Lord's Supper so that no one else could get any. I've been in churches with many odd situations, but have yet to encounter that one. And the Apostle Paul, ministering to these congregations, often speaks to them in a way that goes something like this. You know, friends, I could flaunt my own superiority, but I'm not going to do that. And in many ways, Paul did have a fairly superior resume. He, in fact, studied under Gamaliel, who was the best PhD supervisor around. The risen Jesus appeared to him in a theophany, which pivoted his life. He was named by Jesus as the official missionary to the Gentile world. And in the immediate context of 2 Corinthians chapter 12, Paul describes, though obliquely, a visionary experience, a transporting experience in which he was taken in some way to the third heaven. It's so grandiose, we don't even really know what he's talking about. But he had a grand revelatory experience that was unmatched. And so if he wanted to play that card, he could. But Paul experienced a sharp interruption that prevented conceit to consume him. More on that in a minute. You see, the Corinthians dealt with this spiritual culture of conceit, and conceit, friends, can hide anywhere, even in how we think about the Christian life. One author put it rather poignantly. This theologian writes, "I am very nervous when people speak of the so-called victorious Christian life. So many grandiose testimonies suggest that once Jesus is acknowledged as Lord, the Christian experience becomes a picnic on a green lawn. Difficult marriages blossom into smiley bliss. Physical health flourishes. Bank accounts add up. Acne disappears. And sinking careers suddenly soar. Miracles occur. Church attendance skyrockets. Shy people become gregarious. And the Pittsburgh Pirates win the World Series." In this theology, Jesus becomes a sort of lottery ticket that wins for us success. And this, of course, inflates the ego, because after all, we must have believed well enough or repented earnestly enough for Jesus to manifest his blessings to us so obviously. The undercurrent of this belief is that God is chiefly manifested in our own success, strength, prestige, and power. God is on display when we win, when we get into Boston College's grad program, when we write the bestseller, when our political party wins the election. Consider, for example, the oft-repeated and conceit-ridden charge that is given to college graduates. And if I give you a prompt, you can fill in the gap. You're going to go out there and change the... Wow, you knew it, yeah. A vapid phrase which feeds either narcissism, for people that are deluded enough to think that's going to be true of them, or despair, for those who are honest enough to admit they won't. Martin Luther rightly calls this underscoring belief a theology of glory, that is, of human glory, that stands in stark contrast to the theology of the cross, presented so richly by the New Testament. And a theology of glory, friends, is a not too distant cousin to the atheistic and Nietzschean concept of the will to power. Well, God rescues Paul from religious conceit. How? Through a thorn that pops the bloated balloon of egotism. Now, Paul is no fan of this thorn. In fact, he insults it. He calls it, in Greek, an angel of Satan. He sees it as a tormentor. Now, what is this thorn? What is this angel of Satan? Well, we don't know. It could be a spiritual attack, some unseen force raging against him. Could be a physical or psychological malady. It could be some sort of relational strain and antagonism that he's experiencing from someone in one of his churches. But I like the fact that we don't know, because it universalizes the concept. And now anybody can relate to this passage, where we have a struggle in life that keeps afflicting us, jabbing us, even when we ask for it to be removed. I think that the word thorn is a particularly intriguing descriptor, because what is a thorn? A very small thing that somehow floods the entire body with pain. Anybody knows this who has stepped on a little shard of glass or gotten a splinter? You know how all of a sudden your day was going great and it ain't great no more, because your body is filled with fire and lightning. But a thorn is also a biblically rich symbolic image, because remember in Genesis 3, one of the evidences of the curse on creation is that now creation wars against you, and that war is manifested in thorns. That's why Jesus is crowned with the helmet of thorns as he dies, right? Bearing the curse upon himself. And so Paul is afflicted by this thorn, and yet within God's wild economy, that I'm only beginning to understand, he uses thorns, even the worst things in life, for a redemptive purpose and to remind us of our weakness and our need, and in the long run, to produce beauty within us. That's something about conceit. Now something about weakness. This is verse 8. Three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that it should leave me, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Now, originally, before he starts boasting in weakness, Paul is quite uncomfortable with weakness, and he does a very reasonable thing. He asks for it to stop numerous times so that his life wouldn't be so afflicted. And I simply want to say, friends, that weakness is not romantic. Weakness is rough on us. Weakness is excruciating because it makes us feel very vulnerable and hurtable and undefended. You know, I do a lot of premarital counseling with young people. Sometimes it feels like it's all I do. And I like it much of the time. But I ask a question of the fiancés of the would-be bride and grooms about their families of origin, and what do they learn, and how are they shaped, and I ask them this: what is the cardinal rule of your family that if you break it, you're in a lot of trouble? And almost all of them say the same thing, and that's what's so fascinating. They say the unwritten rule is do not disclose any of our family's problems publicly. I'm not here to criticize that. I understand it. And everybody after Genesis 3 does, because remember what happens as our original anthropological centers collapse and fall. What do they do instinctively? They camouflage their bodies and hide. It's what we do. We hide the weakness. Well, hidden or not, weakness is a synonym for the human condition. We are never as strong as we think. Don't believe me? Get a virus sometime. The tiniest microscopic virus will render us bedridden. A jaggedly worded criticism will make us want to quit our jobs. Betrayal from a friend will permanently damage our emotions, and sometimes we never fully recover. To be fallen is to be weak, is to be complex, is to be internally divided. Brennan Manning, the one-time priest and theologian, put it this way: when I get honest, I admit that I am a bundle of paradoxes. I believe and I doubt. I hope and I get discouraged. I love and I hate. I feel bad about feeling good. I feel guilty when I don't feel guilty. I am trusting and suspicious. I am honest and I still play games. Aristotle said, I am a rational animal. I say, I am an angel with an incredible capacity for beer. Well, this is all of us. We are far more weak than we'd ever like to admit. And when we don't admit it, we grow sour inside and defensive. We won't be open about our vulnerabilities or our errors. We'll just push back. We'll be hostile. We'll be cruel. But the good news of the gospel is that people who are weak have a friend. We, in fact, have the friend, the embodiment of weakness, our own beloved, devastated Christ, who was himself the patron saint of weakness. Consider Paul's words in Philippians 2, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God to be a thing that was grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men, and being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. My favorite artistic piece, and some of you are familiar with this, is Grunewald's triptych entitled The Crucifixion of Christ. In the center of the triptych, Christ is displayed, his twisting body, on the cross. He's actually, on the cross, a victim of the bubonic plague. That's how he was painted. But more than that, his entire body, not just his head with the crown of thorns, his entire body is covered with thorns, as if he was rolled around in them, demonstrating that not only is he covered with pain, he is also bearing, not like Paul, one thorn, but bearing a body's worth of thorns, bearing, in fact, the sin, capriciousness, and self-sabotage of the whole world, mine and yours. This is the Christ who says to Paul, and by proxy says to you, regardless of your weakness, my grace is sufficient for you. And that while we were still weak, Christ died for the ungodly. This is the good news, friends, that in the midst of our own hiddenness, the games we play, the obfuscations, the inner torment, the torture, the self-loathing, all of it, we have someone who understands and decided to get close. To quote Manning again, Jesus came for one caste of people, weaklings, fractured and insolvent souls who are haunted by squalid choices and failed dreams, for the sorely burdened who are still shifting the heavy suitcase of guilt from one wearied hand to another. Jesus came for men and women littered with hereditary faults and limited talents, for the bent and bruised who feel that their lives are, when all is said and done, a grave disappointment to God. The cruciform wisdom of God is this: you are loved as you are and not as you should be, because none of us are as we should be. That you are loved beyond worthiness and unworthiness, beyond fidelity and infidelity, that you are loved in the morning sun and the evening rain, without caution, boundary, limit, nuance, or breaking point. This is the cruciform wisdom of heaven that has landed in the lives of those who are weakened. And so that's something about conceit, something about weakness that is met in our weakened Jesus, and now something about strength, that is true strength, healthy strength. Because in verse 8, Jesus says to Paul in this beautiful bit of revelation, my power is made perfect in weakness. And later, Paul writes, when I am weak, then I am strong. I don't think there's a more beautiful paradox in the world. Nothing that has ever been written is as beautiful as that. Weakness here is seen as a wondrous gift because it cajoles us toward a foreign vitality, a foreign strength that is resourced elsewhere, outside the self. And when we are dependent upon a source other than the self, strength is then purged from egotism. Because it's not about what I have. It's about the resource that somebody else has. And I lean into him and then receive something that I wouldn't have had otherwise. That kind of leaning, that kind of trust, that kind of discovery of strength makes us receptive and nimble. It makes us different on the inside. You know, it's interesting that Paul, many would have considered him innately strong. I mean, he traveled the empire more than Julius Caesar did. He overcame dozens of dangers. He overcame torture. And then he eventually gave his throat to the sword. How did he do that? Well, he had an invincible summer within. And where did he get that? From the friend of those who are weak. This thorn and the weakness that it produced taught Paul not to lean on his own power, but to lean on the limitless fortitude of Jesus Christ. And you may recall what Paul said about his former credentials and his former strength. He says this in Philippians 3. Whatever gains I had, I count as loss for the sake of Christ. For his sake, I have suffered the loss of all things and count them as rubbish in order that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which comes through faith in Christ. And so my urge to you, for all of us, my urge toward myself is this: let your weakness lean. Let your weakness lean. Lean upon the everlasting arms, those brutalized and now risen everlasting arms. When you don't have it, and when you can't see it, and when you don't know how you're going to make it through, well, we've all got someone to turn to. I have two stories, and then I'm done. One from somebody famous, and one from my own life. Not as famous. So, thankfully. This is from actress Viola Davis. If you don't know her material, please get to know it. She's fantastic. My friend was graduating from Bernard University, and Viola spoke at the commencement. And she spoke about her own thorns in the flesh, and she spoke about being a child and growing up neglected and abused in a family ridden with addiction and poverty. And these are the words that she spoke. My testimony is one of poverty, and let me tell you something about poverty. You're invisible. No one sees you when you're poor. You have access to nothing. You're no one's demographic. But you know what my aha moment was? When I was 9 years old, my parents were fighting in the middle of the night, and it was so loud that I started screaming at the top of my lungs that they would stop. And I couldn't stop screaming. I ran into the bathroom, and I got down on my knees, and I closed my eyes, and I clutched my hands together, and I said, God, if you exist, and if you love me, you'll take me away from all of this. I am going to count to 10. And when I open my eyes, I want everything in my life to be different. Do you hear me? Everything. And she says, I put my hands together, and I counted. 1, 2, eventually getting to 9, 10. And then she says, I opened my eyes. And everything was exactly the same. I was still there. And there was still screaming in the background. But a miracle did occur. God kept me in that bathroom and in that family, because he wanted to give me something better than an escape. And so over the years, he gave me vision, and he gave me strength, and he gave me forgiveness, and he gave me empathy, Because now I know what it means to be a hungry child. I know what it means to be in trauma. I know poverty. I know alcoholism. I know what it means to be a kid who dreams and sees no manifestation of it for years. But this was my lesson from God. And please listen to these words. You can only understand people if you feel their pain in yourself. That was my gift, she says. I mean, friends, behold the wisdom gained in weakness. Behold the subterranean power of God that turns weakness into glory. Gave Viola Davis authority and thunder in her voice, but without the ego. That's what happens when we're weak and we trust in the perfect strength of God. We're able to become strong, but without the self-centered conceit. Okay, here's my story. My mother died 6 years ago on September the 11th. She was in many ways a warm and lovely person, but she had a very hard life and suffered from various and severe addictions. She eventually lost her life because of them. I was asked to conduct the funeral service for her, and I was honored to do it. I led the Anglican liturgy in the church and was able to make it through the service without too many hiccups or problems. And then later, after the service, some of you have been to these events, the immediate family only went to the graveside, where the coffin was to be lowered into the earth. Now, the only people there were my siblings and my stepfather and my biological father. She and my biological father divorced when I was 12 years old, rough age for a divorce. But they grew afterward in friendliness toward one another and could be in the same room and laugh together. They were at peace. But there I was, dressed in all my Anglican regalia, prayer book in hand, looking the part. And as the coffin was slowly being lowered into the ground, I was supposed to read the ancient burial prayer that some of you know that goes something like this. In the sure and certain hope of the resurrection unto eternal life, we commend, in this case, our sister Kimberly to the ground. Earth to earth, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. The only problem is that I couldn't say it. I got to the word dust, and I stopped. Now, I had the cheat sheet right in front of me. The prayer book was there. I just had to read. I'm not the smartest man in the world, but I can read English. But there was just something about the finality that got me by the throat. Because now, this all became very real. And now, all of the untidied conversations could never be put right. I could never really say I was sorry, and neither could she. And that choked the words right out of my throat. Well, I don't know how long I was standing there, mute, but it was quite a while. But then I felt something strange. A hand rested on my right shoulder. And I looked around, and it was my father, my biological father. Now, my father, Jack Magnus, is a very good man. But he's not what you would call the affectionate type. I married into an Italian family. They need to read the book Boundaries. And they're all over you, you know? Like, oh, God. Personal space. They never read the book, and they certainly didn't talk to my father. My father is not an affectionate man. He's never done anything like that before, as simple as it sounds to you, I'm sure. But he just rested his hand on my right shoulder. And all of a sudden, something about that gesture quickened me. And I came to, and I was able to finish the prayer, ashes to ashes, dust to dust. We commend our sister to the mercies of God. What happened? In brief, my weakness was met by an externalized strength. And then I could carry on. I could end well. So, friends, that's something about conceit, weakness, and true strength that comes from the reliance upon our beloved Christ. And so, wherever you go, and whatever weaknesses you carry, a hand covered in scar tissue rests upon your shoulder. When you cannot carry on, when you have lost your answers, when you forget the words, when you feel like you're alone in the world, your weakness does not disqualify you. It bonds you with Jesus. Your fragility is your strength, not your damnation. And so how blessed is weakness. How blessed is not knowing all the answers. How blessed is loss. How blessed is the hurt that bonds you to the hurt of Christ. How blessed is unclenching from resentment. How blessed is not having to have the last word. How blessed is feeling out of sorts, because our weakness is the tributary that leads us back to the oceanic Christ. How blessed is letting our weakness lean upon the everlasting arms. And when weakness rests upon the strength of Jesus, well, in the end, God may just make heroes of us all. Amen.